This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What is a tax increment finance district? The economic development tool dominated debate at Cincinnati City Hall this week, so we start the Friday News Review with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Dan Horn, who is here to help us understand TIFs. Dan, welcome. Thank you for being here.
No problem. TIFs are slightly less complicated than microphone system.
You know, I'm wearing an ugly Christmas sweater because we're doing a thing here in the office, and I can tell you I am now dripping in sweat underneath it, but we're ready to proceed with the show. So anyway, the City Hall was pretty much dominated by conversation and debate about something called a tax increment finance district, or a TIF,
right,
this week. Before we get into the weeds about why it was an important topic in this city this week, what is a TIF?
Okay. As you said, a TIF stands for tax increment financing. And basically what these TIF districts do is they create an area that can't be bigger than 300 acres in a low-income area. And within that area, what happens is as property taxes go up, because property values go up, the amount of the increase, the tax increment, is skimmed off the top and deposited in a special fund in these TIF districts. And those districts can then use that money for development purposes. They can patch streets, they can fix sidewalks, they can buy dilapidated housing to be torn down for development. Any sort of development-related investment they can then do with that money from the property taxes.
But that money that's skimmed off the top is to be invested directly back into the boundaries established by the
Correct.
TIF.
Correct. It's taken from the from within the boundaries of the TIF, and it is then spent within the boundaries of that TIF.
How is it different than just typical collection of property tax?
Well, it's not really. I mean, all the taxes collected, as it always is, no one pays more taxes because of this. But instead of that TIF money going into all the other things that property tax money covers, like zoos and libraries and schools and whatever else property tax money covers, it goes into a fund that's used for development within that district. And it takes time for the money to build up, but as it builds up, it can then be spent on all these development tools.
Why is it controversial in Cincinnati right now?
Well, because people who would otherwise get that money believe that it's depriving them of resources that they could use as opposed to being spent in these individual districts. Schools in particular are concerned about this because in theory, even though taxes aren't going up and even though the original amount of money that was spent that they would receive from private taxes doesn't change, they aren't getting new money. And so nothing's free. The money goes into the TIF district. It's not going to somebody else. So those folks are concerned about that.
Okay. And what are some of the projects that we know of in recent years that have tried to benefit from this establishment of a TIF district?
Well, in Avondale, they did the Avondale Town Center, got about $2 million in TIF money. They used that money to buy dilapidated housing that was then raised, and they built retail space on that. The West End is going to use about $7 million related to the stadium project there. There's been street repairs done in numerous places from Price Hill to the West End to OTR has received a lot of money. There's a $12 million TIF fund in OTR that's used for development down there. So a lot of the stuff you see in your community in some of these TIF districts is done with TIF money.
And is the argument from the development community that a lot of these projects just would not be economically feasible from their end were there not an establishment of a TIF?
Right. A lot of these neighborhoods are struggling, and the rule is these can only be done in neighbors that are considered low income. And without this infusion of cash, the argument goes, there would not be new investment. So if you're not in a position to fix these streets, to fix these sidewalks, to tear down these old buildings, then developers aren't going to come in and do the things that you want them to do in your community.
And so it sounds like there is concern at the city level, at the level of the Board of Education. Can you describe the process through which TIF approval goes?
Right. Well, any TIF project does have to be voted on by council, so there's oversight after that. But once the TIF council approves the TIF, they create these districts and the money starts piling up. And then over time, they spend the money on projects. As those projects come up, they just can't spend it on anything. Council does have to approve it again. Now, the school board comes into play because there's under the law, you can have a side deal with schools in your community to receive a portion of money they otherwise wouldn't receive because of the TIF. And so that's part of the conversation going on right now, a broader conversation about tax abatement, tax incentives between the city and the school board about what is that percentage? How do we keep that balance so the schools aren't actually losing money? The city says it's committed to keeping the district whole when it comes to TIFs and to tax incentives. The school board has a different view of what that percentage should be than the city does, though, and that's where there's a lot of argument.
So there is, there could be a situation where the Board of Education is negotiating some type of tax rate with the developer or some type of
monetary payment? Yeah, not directly in this case. They negotiate with the city in advance to determine what percentage of the TIF money they get. Currently, the schools get 27% of TIF money. The city argues that, hey, that's a great deal for the schools because school levies often are what's called fixed sum levies. They don't get new tax revenue anyway as property taxes go up. The schools say, well, not every levy works that way. And there are some other considerations with state funding that come into play that affect that share that we get. So they're going back and forth right now about what the right percent is.
Okay. So I got a call from former Mayor Mark Mallory just today.
Sure.
I imagine he must have heard a promo for this show where we previewed that we would be talking about the TIF debate that took place in Cincinnati this week. And he just wanted to let us know and to discuss that he credits his father, State
sure.
Senator William Mallory, who as the father, not just of him, but as the father of TIFs in Ohio, he said that projects like Riverfront Stadium and Fountain Square South were able to utilize tools like this. And I think the former mayor was advocating in favor of this tool
sure.
as something that created these once legacy projects that people can either remember or still see. He said, my father focused his entire life for bringing resources to communities who didn't have a great voice in Columbus, and he saw the use of TIF as a way for neighborhoods to be able to get projects done that probably would not otherwise be able to be financed. Again, that was former Mayor Mark Mallory who talked to me on the phone earlier today. Is that an argument that you're hearing from neighborhoods, that neighborhoods are excited about the prospects and the utilization of TIF opportunities?
Yeah, a lot of neighborhoods are supportive of this. Not surprisingly, the idea of keeping a lot of that tax money in the neighborhood is appealing to a lot of these community councils and a lot of the folks who want to see more development in their neighborhood. I think if there's a concern, and I did hear some of this from some of the communities as well, it's who makes the decisions about what development comes in. Some of them are concerned about losing control of the kind of development that comes into their communities. Council would have say, but they would not necessarily have direct say. And so there's some concern about that. But overall, yeah, I mean, this has been a bipartisan issue, and there have been Republicans and Democrats who support TIFs. The idea of keeping money closer to home has appeal across all political lines.
So as we said, there was debate at Cincinnati City Hall this week. What ultimately was decided?
Well, the council approved the new 15 TIF districts that were proposed. So currently, the city has 20 of them. The proposal was for 15 new ones. Council approved all of them. And again, this was it was 7-1, 8-0 vote on all of them. So there wasn't a lot of opposition on council. There was opposition there among some school union, teachers union folks and other folks who don't like the idea of siphoning off some money from property taxes to these TIF districts. But they did not have a lot of political opposition on council itself.
Was there any argument to delay this process a little bit for further review?
There was a couple council members as well as a lot of the people who were critical of this wanted a full audit of the current TIFs to see how much money was in there. We now know how much. There's about $35 million by my count in these accounts overall. But they wanted an audit of how that money's been spent, how much is there, how much everybody has. Some of that is available in public records currently. Some of the council members who voted for these TIFs said, we favor an audit, but we're not going to stop these TIFs from going forward just to get an audit now.
That's Enquirer reporter Dan Horn. He has a full explainer up this week on TIF districts, and it's pretty much item by item how taxes are impacted, who appears to benefit, who may suffer a little bit of a loss when these things are adopted. Dan Horn from the Enquirer, you could read that at Cincinnati.com, and if you Google specifically Enquirer Dan Horn, like I do, to see what you've got coming up, you'll be able to go right to his page and read all of his latest content. Dan Horn, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. Happy New Year.
Thanks,
to you.
You too. Nice sweater.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a little sweaty now, but we're good. Thank you. There's a new report that shows a disparity in the number of traffic tickets dismissed for white drivers when compared to those issued to black drivers, among other findings. So let's continue the Friday News Review now with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Max Lundberg, who joins us in the studio. Hi, Max.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Give us the background on what you found in the reporting that you did this week.
Sure. So we found racial disparities in how people are stopped in traffic stops by Cincinnati police. This disparities, we looked at predominantly black neighborhoods and compared them to predominantly white neighborhoods across the city. and found that in predominantly black neighborhoods, residents are stopped more often than in predominantly white ones. And we use predominantly as 75% of the population or more, and found that on a per resident stop basis, 120% more stops are made in the black areas than in the white ones. We also found that blacks are arrested more often when stopped. They made up 75% of all stop arrests, which is obviously far more than whites are arrested.
And this was a partnership that the Enquirer did with the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism.
Correct.
Okay. And on the phone with us is Eye on Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism Executive Director Lucia Walenchis. Thank you for joining us to talk about this important story. Talk about the role that the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism played in gathering this data for the context of this report.
Sure. So we gathered some public records from Cleveland, and also we'd give a big shout out to Stanford University. Their big local news program gathered the majority of the records. They gathered the Cincinnati records and also most of the Columbus ones. So, you know, we were able to look at, you know, not only the different stops and we also in some cases, you know, Columbus searches and in all the places arrests as well.
How long did you work on gathering these details, Lucia?
Oh, wow. We've been working on this since March. So I looked back in our folder and it had about 25 gigs worth of data and over 2,000 files. So this definitely was a big lift, but it was a really interesting project, and I think we learned a lot.
It's possible that our listeners, some of them anyway, may be unfamiliar with Eye on Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism. Can you tell us briefly what it is and then how the journalists there were able to comb through all these details?
Sure. So we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit news source in Ohio, and our goal is to, you know, promote the public good through, you know, in-depth sort of long-form stories. And obviously we cover state government and, you know, this sort of thing a lot. We obviously rely on our media partners, you know, for their local expertise. And, you know, Max did a great job of being able to interview a lot of people in Cincinnati. And, you know, we provided a lot of expertise and we did a lot of this in R, and then, you know, we made Tableau maps of it and so on and so forth. So I think we did, I think it was a really great project and, you know, everyone kind of contributed their own, you know, expertise there.
Max Lonberg is the reporter from the Cincinnati Enquirer who helped contextualize this data through some reporting. And one of the headlines attributed to one of the stories that was published, Max, said, "Biracial man's white tickets dismissed, black tickets sustained." Give us the background on that.
Sure. So Jeremiah Miller was pulled over 4 times last year in separate incidents. He was charged with driving under suspension and other charges in each of them. So while it wasn't a scientific comparison, there were many similarities between his stops. He's biracial, self-described, pale skin. Sometimes cops perceive him to be white, sometimes black. In the 4 stops last year, he was in 2 of the stops from last year, he was listed as black on the ticket. In the other 2, he was listed as white. In the 2 white tickets, those charges were dismissed. In his 2 black tickets, they were sustained and he was convicted.
Was there a difference in the traffic violation, the alleged traffic violation?
Each of them had a driving under suspension charge.
So they were all
varied. They were the same in that sense, but some of them had additional underlying charges as well, such as speeding, running a stop sign, not displaying a license plate.
And was there any reaction from judicial officials who maybe were able to explain that discrepancy?
We spoke with a judge who handled 3 of the cases, Judge Bernie Bouchard. He said, you know, race didn't play a factor at all in his courtroom. And we also spoke with police about this, who said many different factors play into a court case, which is something that we acknowledge in the story. But we also acknowledge that from Jeremiah Miller's perspective, he was feeling that the system was biased. He was feeling that he was being untreated fairly. When he's listed as black, the system is hitting him harder from his perspective.
How were you able to find him?
That's a great question. I was hanging out at the courthouse during traffic court, talking to people, just introducing myself, telling them about the project that we were working on. asking if they had any stories they could share.
And he was there for one of his appearances, and you were able to include him in this story.
Right.
I'm looking at some of the key findings from the analysis that, again, this is the Cincinnati Inquirer working cooperatively with Eye on Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism, whose executive director, Lucia Walinches, is also with us on the phone. It looked like of the three cities that were analyzed, Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland, Cincinnati had a lot more instances of total stops per resident in predominantly black areas when compared to Columbus or Cleveland. And I'm wondering, Lucia, was there any understanding about why that might be?
Sure. Well, we actually, we weren't able to get exactly the same data sets for each one. So in Columbus, the stops are only vehicle stops in terms of traffic stops. And in Cleveland, actually, it's just the tickets there. We don't have, if someone was just pulled over and they got a warning or, they didn't get anything, that's not reflected in the Cleveland data. But, we definitely see a very similar pattern in that, African-Americans not only get more tickets, but the places that they get more tickets, we compared, as Max mentioned, predominantly black neighborhoods, predominantly white neighborhoods, and just the sheer number of tickets issued was much higher there in black compared to white.
Lucia, was there anything about the data collected that surprised you and your team?
Oh, absolutely. Something really brilliant that Stanford showed us how to do was something called the Veil of Darkness test. And obviously this is just a theory, but, it's obviously at a baseline we realized, wow, there's a whole lot more African-American stops compared to their population percentage. And, why is that? It must be because, the police are profiling, are trying to pull over more African-Americans. Using this Veil of Darkness test, essentially we looked at the exact same time of day, but because of the seasons and because of the daylight savings time, we were able to, geolocate each stop and look at the timestamp and see if you could actually see a driver, before you pulled them over. And in all three places, actually, we found that blacks are pulled over much higher, but at about the same rate each time. So that, needless to say, sort of confused us for a long time. Why is it that this would be very similar? So then we thought, what if it's not that the police are picking out drivers, but what if the police are already in an African-American neighborhood to start with? And then that leads to more tickets. So what we did was we then looked at the geolocation of each stop. And then we also looked at census data and the demographic data within each census block. So, we were able to kind of compare the one to the other and see, we're able to see that there's this sort of clustering effect, which could affect the number of tickets issued.
According to the analysis, in Cincinnati, police made 120% more total stops per resident in predominantly black areas. Max Lonberg from the Cincinnati Inquirer, what parts of town are considered predominantly black areas that were analyzed here?
The parts of town that we considered, Price Hill was a big one. In that area, there was a stop in 2018 when a woman had pulled into Mount Echo Park. She just wanted to take in the view, and an officer followed her into the park and told her to leave, despite the park being open. And so that's one of the areas where we found a higher stop rate for citizens. And this woman, when she was told to leave the park, she felt like she should make a complaint. She felt like she'd been mistreated, unfairly targeted by police. And she made a complaint to the Citizen Complaint Authority, which is an independent agency that investigates accusations against police. And the agency interviewed the officer who pulled her over, who said, this is an area where we have frequent heroin users, but did not specify, according to the complaint report, why that officer suspected this woman. And so ultimately, the cop was cleared, and we found from an analysis of many complaints that were lodged against police to this agency of more than 225 since 2014 regarding bias complaints or improper stop complaints, only four were validated, meaning four were found to found in the citizen's favor.
You can read the full reporting at the Cincinnati Inquirer. I want to thank Inquirer reporter Max Lonberg and Eye on Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism Executive Director Lucio Valencias, for joining us on the phone. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Now that impeachment is set to head to the Senate, what can we expect from our local senators? And noise from Kings Island is upsetting neighbors in Mason. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. President Donald Trump this week became the third in U.S. history to be impeached by the House of Representatives. The next phase, the trial, takes place in the Senate. What should we expect from our local senators? And joining me now is WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard.
Hello, Michael.
Big week in our nation's history. Historic moment, really.
Yes, absolutely. Anytime that this happens, and it hasn't happened very often, impeachment of a president. It's serious business.
And the role that members of Congress play in it will also be remembered, certainly distinctly at a local level. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about what our local federal delegation has done so far and what may do as this process moves over to the Senate.
Sure.
As far as our Congress members are concerned, those from Southwest Ohio, Northern Kentucky, and Southeast Indiana did not surprise all Republicans and voted against both articles of impeachment against President Trump. So no surprise there. But now this is going to the Senate, and one representative in the Senate from our area, represents part of our area, is the most important member of the Senate and possibly the most powerful politician in the country, and that is Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So far, he has lambasted the process through the House, calling it unfair, calling it a sham, buying into the president's talking points. Is there a possibility that this process could become more serious than he has let on, or does he remain the gatekeeper?
Well, he's a gatekeeper for now, but things can change very quickly in this kind of situation. Nancy Pelosi, obviously, you know, holding back on delivering the articles of impeachment to the Senate, and Mitch McConnell was not very happy about that. He said, "No, you know, we need these. We got to get this behind us." Blah blah blah. He wants it now, and he wants to make it short and quick and over. So that not so much for Donald Trump, but for those senators who are running for re-election next year, so that they don't have to walk around and explain this for the next 9 months.
McConnell is a very interesting case study in the age of Trump, because mm-hmm. one of Trump's mantras during the campaign was drain the swamp. And I right. don't mean to editorialize and associate McConnell with the swamp, but the way the swamp was characterized was basically establishment Washington. And is there anyone who better
no.
exemplifies establishment right. Washington than McConnell? And in spite of having difficulties in this age of Trump, this has been the best era of McConnell's political career. He has said so himself. How has he managed to navigate that?
Because he's just a very, very skillful and very clever politician. I mean, he knows how to game the system. He knows how to build a majority. You know, he raised a whole lot of money to get into that position for a lot of Senate candidates, Republican Senate candidates. And that's how you gain power in Washington. That's how you get into positions like Senate Majority Leader, because you helped so many of those people get there themselves who otherwise may not have been elected.
And the consequence has been that Senator McConnell has been able in the past couple of years to fully reshape the federal judiciary.
Yes.
What is the type of impact that that could have? This has been a dream of conservative politicians for a long time.
Right. And that's, you know, obviously one of the most lasting pieces of what his legacy, whenever he does go, if he goes this year, you know, he's up for reelection. But, you know, if he stays around for who knows how long, that will be part of his lasting legacy, the impact that he's had on the judicial system. And also just the power that he wields and doesn't seem to, you know, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. It's, you know, he gets what he wants, and he's very patient in terms of holding out for what he wants.
Another senator from Kentucky, the other senator from Kentucky, junior senator Republican Rand Paul, has also had some evolution in the age of Trump. You recall, of course, that Rand Paul was a primary opponent back when Trump was running in 2016. Rand Paul, he got into a couple of tiffs on live television during some debates, but Rand Paul has come around to be a strong champion on behalf of Donald Trump as well. What's the story behind his evolution, which I think is somewhat different than McConnell's?
Hell yeah, it's much different than McConnell's. I think it can be explained by one number, and that's 30%, which is how much Donald Trump won Kentucky by in 2016. And, you know, without Donald Trump, Matt Bevin would have just gotten rolled over in that recent election. And Rand Paul knows the popularity of Donald Trump in Kentucky, and it continues to this day. So that pretty much explains it for me, that, you know, that's why he looks at him differently.
In Ohio, we know Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown will vote in favor of the articles more than likely. He's indicated as much in conversations he's had with us on this program. But then there's Republican Senator Rob Portman from here in the Cincinnati area. Mm-hmm. He could be a curious case because, as we talked about on the Political Junkie show, Nancy Pelosi may have a strategy of holding on to the impeachment process before delivering it to the Senate. And this may be an effort to see if there is some support from just a handful of Republicans to come on the side of the Democrats, not on impeachment, but rather for the process of the trial. Would they vote with a majority of senators to allow for witnesses and more evidence to be presented? Is Rob Portman a target of that particular effort?
I think he would be. I think they would look at him probably not as a leader of that movement, but as somebody who might be willing to go along. You know, he said since the start that he is not, he doesn't think that these are impeachable offenses that have been placed before the Senate, although he claims he's going to listen and he's going to be fair and that sort of thing. I don't know how you can have it both ways, but no, he's somebody that they would approach, I would think, because he has this reputation as a moderate and a person who has, through his career in Congress, been willing to reach across the aisle.
Howard, I hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I have a feeling we'll have plenty of politics to talk about in 2020.
Yes, sir. I think we will. You too.
So the noise from Kings Island is upsetting neighbors in Mason, and the so-called Gang of Five Cincinnati City Council members could face a criminal investigation. The Friday News Review continues now with WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. What's the latest with these five council members who, by the way, called themselves the Gang of Five? They branded this in their text messages that five of them were sharing with each other in apparent violation of the Sunshine Laws. This isn't over.
Right. Well, we kind of thought it might have been, but then Ohio's Auditor Keith Faber started looking into it, and he said, well, maybe there could be some dereliction of duty here. So he's recommended that, you know, the county look into it. So Prosecutor Joe Dieters was in contact with the city of Cincinnati, Paula Boggs-Muthing, their city solicitor, to sort of say, well, you know, probably shouldn't be Dieters that does the prosecuting. And they asked a bunch of other cities if any of them would like to step in and look into the case. And they all said, no, thank you. So they've hired an outside attorney now, Patrick Hanley, who's going to kind of investigate, see if their misconduct, which they've admitted to. They did, in fact, conduct city business via text message, you know, not sunshiny, and to determine if, you know, the case should be taken to a grand jury and potentially brought to some sort of trial.
The saga goes on. We'll continue to follow that. But you had a great story this week. Kings Island.
Yeah.
Too noisy for some of the neighbors after all these years?
Right. Okay. So I do feel like maybe because a lot of people, the reaction to the story has been like, suck it up. You chose to live next to an amusement park. And the neighbors admit that they understand that. But I feel like I really should point out a lot of people said, why are you just now complaining? So these neighbors have been worried about the noise from Diamondback. And it's not just people yelling. It's the noise of the roller coaster.
It's that specific coaster.
It's that specific coaster that they're saying. And they did go to Kings Island, they say, 10 years ago, and they've had conversations with the folks at Kings Island, and they basically said, well, there's nothing that can be done to make it less loud. And so the neighbors have just said, well, okay, we've lived with it. Then this summer, you know, there's the announcement of Orion, which is going to be the same type of coaster, only bigger and therefore noisier, which it's made by the way the coaster is made. It makes the sound when the train goes across the tracks. It makes it reverberate even louder.
Oh.
So it's going to be the same type of coaster coming in. So they're worried that's going to be equally as loud. And these neighbors happened to come across a video where someone explained that the track can actually be filled with sand to damp the noise down. And this, in fact, has been used at other Cedar Fair parks, like Canada's Wonderland in Canada. I just
really?
Like I should throw that
yeah,
in there.
Sure, of course.
So they went back to Kings Island and said, hey, could you do this? And they say they haven't heard anything back from Kings Island any further. And so that's sort of the impetus. They, you know, they went to Mason. They tried. Mason has a noise ordinance. But they went to a city council meeting and they sort of said, well, you know, it's kind of outdated. We don't really think we can enforce it, so we're not going to. So the neighbors have said, well, we'll try reaching out to the media and having our side heard.
And you are the media, and you reported this story. And is there anything next to this? Is something coming?
Well, Kings Island did tell us that they're aware of the neighbors' concerns. They're looking into it. But that's all about we know. The neighbors have also reached out to some of their state leaders, you know, beyond just the Mason and Deerfield Township leaders. And so, you know, they've been directed to talk to a few other people up in the state house area. So we'll see. There could be more. And they're also saying, you know, they live to the one side, the southern side of Kings Island, but Orion is being built on the northern side. So they're saying that, you know, the noise from it could affect a lot more neighbors.
How loud are you on a roller coaster?
Well, you know, you have to shout Mexican food items. Did you know that?
Is that how it works?
Yes. When you ride a roller coaster, you're supposed to yell like guacamole.
Really?
Yeah,
why?
Did you not know this?
I didn't know that.
I don't know. Take it up with my cousins in Missouri.
I'll call them later. Tana Weingartner, WVXU reporter. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
And we will have an all-star panel coming up next to talk about some hot Christmas topics. That's next on Cincinnati Edition. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. This is our last show of the year. So I've invited some local journalists on to join us for a panel discussion about all things Christmas and New Year's. So here in the studio with me now, our Cincinnati Inquirer columnist, Byron McCauley. Welcome back, Byron.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We also have with us Wine Me, Dine Me writer and WVXU Bits and Bytes contributor, Julie Neeson. Welcome back, Julie.
Hello.
And for the first time with us is locally based humor writer Ryan Kontz, whose work has appeared in The New Yorker and McSweeney's and other publications. He's got a new book out. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And also here for the first time in my tenure is a very frightened and nervous WVXU digital editor, Jennifer Merritt. Jen, yes. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you. I'm the internet troll, usually behind the screen.
Yeah, so. She's the one responding to your comments or deleting them if
or
they are mean.
Deleting them, yep.
Also, that's the odds.
That's yeah. It. Okay, I want to get started because it is Hallmark Christmas movie season, and that is a channel that is very well known for its countdown to Christmas and the Hallmark movies that they put out. This is their time to shine, but man, did they have some bad press in the past.
Whoops.
Several days. There was a commercial that was airing on the station featuring a same-sex kiss. Two women were involved in this ad, and they pulled it after some complaints because it doesn't fit their brand. You know, in the Hallmark movies, it's white man, white woman falling in love and very limited diversity on these films. So they pulled it. Boycott Hallmark started a trend on Twitter. And ultimately, it got to be such a big deal that Hallmark reinstated the ad. And that upset its other viewers so much more. So I want to start by asking the panel, what do we make of this? Here we are at the dawn of the third decade of this century. Are we still being upset by same-sex kissing?
All I have to say is that Hallmark needs to diversify. I mean, they lost Aunt Becky, and I mean, that's a big loss. That's like half of their catalog, and they have to do something. So, like, let's spice it up a little bit. Let's show two people of the same sex kissing. Whoa!
But there is a very significant formula to the way Hallmark movies are created. They follow a similar plot line, similar types of significant moments within a storyline happen at certain parts within these stories. And even between the straight couples that are ultimately the heroes of the story, there's limited action. Like, there's limited kissing. Very gentle pecking, I think, is probably the most appropriate way to describe that.
Yeah. You know, with Hallmark, and this is a great question for my wife, because she's definitely a Hallmark fan. But when I think about Hallmark, you know, it's always an opportunity for learning, right? They can learn from this and I think grow from this. Hallmark does have a unique brand. We know what's going to happen. It's going to be a handsome guy from New York, and he's going to this small town. He's going to, you know, they're going to go on over and...
Or the other way around,
right? And that's the way it's going to end. But, you know, like you said, we are in the third decade, right? And there's an opportunity, I think, to learn and grow from this, even if you're Hallmark, with your formula.
And Ryan, I invited you on the show because you clearly have a certain special understanding of Christmas movies made for television.
Thank you. Yes, so much. Yeah, I feel like there's nothing about, there are several Hallmark formulas and just none of them preclude gay couples from participating. Like, you can be part of a gay couple who is a terrible lawyer who doesn't spend enough time with his son and needs to go to a small town to learn an important lesson and also end up like chastely kissing another man. You could be a lesbian finding out that you're secretly a princess and, you know, need to go overseas to rule your kingdom. It's just keep your formulas in place, Hallmark. Like, that's your gold. But the other part is there's already a title out there for them. Make the Yuletide Gay. It's a movie.
It's true.
I don't know why they haven't made it. It feels like it's waiting for them.
Here are some of the upcoming titles, by the way, because they don't really, they're not very creative, right? Not as clever as that. It's The Mistletoe Secret, Christmas Under the Stars, Christmas at Graceland, Christmas Wishes, and Mistletoe Kisses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, if Elvis's ghost can be involved, there can be a same-sex kiss.
Elvis ghost involved. But I do have to admit that now that I've looked this up, I am very excited to see Jesse Metcalf as the leading man in Christmas Under the Stars. I mean, you remember Jesse Metcalf from Passions, the NBC soap opera, and he was on the Housewives, Desperate Housewives.
Here he's being played by Candace Cameron Bure.
Basically, that's who leads these films, right, Ryan?
Give me a film with Candace Cameron Bure and Lacey Chabert together.
Who used to be a little more famous and now...
Yes, they found a second career.
Yeah.
And now they're just very wholesome.
Yes.
They're like full fat milk.
Well, and too, I also don't want to forget the scandal that they had earlier with the Jewish community finally incorporating some Jewish themes that trafficked in some Jewish tropes and was not received very well.
Oh, Hallmark. Well.
So. Yeah, they've got a way. And their other brands are pretty inclusive. Their greeting cards, all their other products. It's just this channel is a little bit different. But we are talking about these because Ryan actually has a new book out. And you all remember Make Your Own Adventure, Build Your Own Adventure books, right? Yes, okay, so Ryan has written one that is Build Your Own Christmas TV romance, and it's really great. It's a good-looking book, and it's exactly what you think it is. You read through it, you get to a spot where you're given some choices, and you pick a choice, and that's the next page that you will go to. And I asked you basically to summarize a little piece, and then collectively, as the rest of the panel, we're going to make a choice on where to go next. So would you just fill us in on what we need to think about here?
Yes. This one has a quick little intro. Basically, at this point in the book, Chrissy, who is our main character, is having some boy troubles. In her magical small town. Yeah, he's wearing these chunky sweaters. He's a single dad. She's all a flutter. So she's calling her best friend, Holly, who hasn't appeared in the book yet, to get some advice. So if you're reading this, she's on the phone, and the choice you're presented with is what kind of best friend is Holly going to be? So the choice is, should Holly be Chrissy's sarcastic best friend from the city? You'd go to page 92. Chrissy's friend whose answer to any problem is shopping, 93. Or talking to Chrissy while simultaneously trying to hold another conversation. That's 95.
Ooh, so what do we think? Do we like big city best friend? Do we like shopping best friend or the inattentive best friend?
Oh, I think I like shopping best friend.
I tend to be a shopper. I would vote. We got two votes for shopper.
I'm going to say big city.
I'm going for big city too. All right, we'll give the ladies the tie break there. Yes. We're going big city friend. What happens?
All right, sarcastic best friend from the city. You know what else is sweet and cute? Holly asked. Holly's the best friend. A nectarine with googly eyes glued on it. And do you know what makes a terrible husband? She paused dramatically for effect. A nectarine with googly eyes glued on it, she concluded. Come on, Chrissy said. I really need your help here. What do I do about Nick? Nicholas Bell is the love interest.
Oh.
Ew, said Holly. First of all, we can't forget the fact that he's a townie. I know, admitted Chrissy. He's a genuine, born and bred Candy Cane Falls townie. So if you got together, Holly continued, that would mean what? You'd never come back to New York? You'd waste away in Candy Cane Falls? I mean, you may as well move to the moon, or worse. She paused in disgust. Queens. I wouldn't call it wasting away, Chrissy countered, but she'd be lying if she hadn't thought the same thing. She liked doing business in the city, where many businesses and buildings were. What would she do in Candy Cane Falls? There weren't any business buildings there. She crinkled up her nose. Don't crinkle up your nose like that, Holly said. I can hear you doing it through the phone. It makes you look like one of those bald Sphinx cats. Chrissy tried to relax her face. How did Holly know? You know, Chrissy said, I'm kind of going through something here, and some encouragement would be nice. Sorry, Chris, Holly said. You know I love you. But you also know that I pride myself on being brutally honest. That's my whole thing. I've taken my decision to deploy casual, off-putting cruelty toward everyone in my life, and I've somehow successfully rebranded myself into someone who just tells it like it is. That's remarkably self-aware, said Chrissy, but just this once, couldn't you? If you want to make someone make you feel better, Holly interrupted, talk to a doctor. If you want someone to tell you the truth, talk to me. But you're a doctor. A pediatric neurosurgeon. Oh, I have very poor bedside manner, Holly conceded. But you have to admit it. You love me. I say things like, we'll be best friends forever because you already know too much. I have like 6 fluent and sarcasm coffee mugs because people are always giving them to me, saying, this made me think of you. I'm just a whole situation of a person. So you're saying I should let the whole Nick thing go, Chrissy said. I'm just saying, Holly said, that it's like my favorite Henry Ford quote. Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you can't. I don't think that's how the quote goes, Chrissy said. Look, Holly said, I'm just here to act as a sounding board and drive the plot along, so I'm going to let you go. Talk to you never. Big city forever. Uh-huh.
That's good, Ryan. Thank you so much for reading that. Oh, the name of the book is Build Your Own Christmas Movie Romance by Ryan Kahns. Google it. Look for it. It's very enjoyable. So you can basically get the idea that you build the adventure there. So now in our last 5 minutes together, we got some things to get through. And I know that each of you have a specialty, which is why that I brought you in as well, in addition to Ryan's specialty. And Jen is here to tell us, what were the most interesting stories of the year at WVXU.org? Can you quickly give us the 3 biggest?
Well, what I thought was most interesting was that a lot of them resurfaced in that just in this last week. We're talking Gang of Five, Kings Island, and the Hamilton County Dog Warden drama, TIFF districts. And then a few that I just thought were worth mentioning were the Reds, who, while they had a losing season, had a very interesting year in terms of the celebration.
Sure, yeah.
And Marty Brenneman.
It was an anniversary year, Marty Brenneman, yeah.
And then also the loss of Marion Spencer.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, so, it was a good year for the website, though, and you've done a nice job with that.
Thank you.
So very cool that we got some nice traffic there at the end of December.
Yeah.
Julie, what was some of the big food news in town this year?
Oh, let's see. Well, there's Downtown Kroger, you know, my favorite topic. that was a really big deal, bringing a world-class grocery store to the Central Business District. We've had lots of new restaurant openings, tons of things opening up near Findlay Market. I'm thinking Goose and Elder. I'm thinking Social OTR, which has a social justice aspect to it.
Yeah.
So the folks who work there are people who are disadvantaged, who are learning new skills, which I think is fantastic.
And what's the one thing somebody in Cincinnati has to eat at the holidays?
Oh, well, I would say the Boca Burger because, you know, I'm tired of holiday food. We discussed this the last time I was on, and the Boca Burger is ridiculously good and only available for a limited time.
And she's going to have a piece about it on Monday.
Yes, I am. Cool. Yeah.
At WVXU.org.
Yes,
so
indeed.
There's still time this year to be the number one article on the website. We'll see how that goes for you.
Would there be green bean casserole on the side?
We talked about that last time.
That's just not even nice.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I had some at Thanksgiving, by the way.
It was
delicious.
I'm so sorry.
Byron, your new sugar plum and Lumps of Coal column is out in the Inquirer. You gave Sugar Plum to Blink Cincinnati. That's a huge event. What a great event.
Oh my gosh. Blink Cincinnati was just a spectacle in Cincinnati. And we are so happy to have had that.
Historic.
1.5 million people downtown and over the river into Covington. And really, really great art and art installations and people having great fun parties. It was like Cincinnati on super steroids, and we were all together. I mean, it really kind of felt like a 3 days of Times Square.
Everybody, not only was it like everybody was able to enjoy this same thing, but it connected Kentucky and Ohio, which doesn't happen a whole lot. And
Absolutely.
So it was a very seamless thing where people from Cincinnati were going into Covington. I never see that. And so
that was
really cool.
That's right.
And there are more sugar plums that you gave out. People can read your column, but I want to note that you gave a lump of coal to former Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin.
Wow, wow. Let me tell you something. Matt Bevin has turned out to be a pretty disappointing some of his actions as he's going out. I mean, he paroled people that you wouldn't believe, you know,
people's opinions, people in public opinion tend to improve once they're out of office. He seems to be taking a different approach to
He sort of had a self-inflicted nosedive there. So it's really tragic.
But, more sugar plums and lumps of coal handed out in Byron McCauley's column in our last couple of minutes. Now I want to just do some rapid-fire Christmas questions from all of you, or for all of you. I'm going to ask first, what is the worst Christmas song that we hear, Byron?
Oh, I think George Michael's
Last Christmas.
Last Christmas song.
Are you out of your
That's
mind?
Probably,
offensive.
That's probably one of the worst out there, I'm thinking.
Ryan?
Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time.
My thoughts
Every
exactly.
time you say it, I'm having less of a wonderful
Me
Christmas
too.
Time.
Me too. Worst Christmas song. Julie?
All of them.
Ooh. Oh. You were just not festive this time of year. Your lovely
not.
Red lipstick on.
Thank you.
All right. Jen?
Baby, it's cold outside. Just
It's kind of creepy.
It
Real
does
creepy.
Get a little
it's creepy.
A creepy. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Best Christmas song, Byron.
Oh, Please Come Home for Christmas.
Which version? Barry Neville?
Well, you know what? I'm thinking about Charles Brown, the great blues man from down south. Okay. You know, if not by Christmas, by New Year's night.
All right. So,
I love a good creepy Christmas song, like your Carol of the Bells. Like, this is supposed
that's
to spook
intense.
Me.
That's intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I do have a best. I love the Nutcracker Suite.
Oh, yeah. You can't go wrong with that one. Jen?
Mariah Carey all the way. All I want for Christmas is
Well, you're all wrong. The best Christmas song is Oh Holy Night, John Barry's version, or A Tie with Mary Did You Know, Kathy Mattea's version. Fruitcake, good or bad?
Terrible.
Excellent.
See?
Can be good.
Can be
Often
good.
Often is not.
Have never tried it.
Never even tried it. It just has a bad reputation and you stay away from it.
Yeah.
Okay, what's your New Year's resolution?
To spend way less time doing things that are not important.
Interesting.
I'm going to keep flossing. I'm going to take the momentum.
The dance or the teeth?
No. Oh, you know, both simultaneously if possible. But if I had to, like, prioritize the teeth one.
Good call. Yeah. All right, Julie.
Oh, geez. I'm going to exercise more consistently than I have over the past 3 months.
Awesome. Jen?
Maybe relax a little bit more the next time if I get invited back on Cincinnati Edition.
You will be, because my New Year's resolution is to have all of you back in the new year. This was fun.
Oh.
Thanks for being here. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. This is our last show of the year. We are back in January. Thanks to all of you for listening. And thanks to you, Julie, Ryan, Byron, and Jen for being here. I'm Michael Monks. Catch you in January.
During the holidays, it's easy to lose sight of what it is we're celebrating.
One of the most important things I can do while I'm on this planet is honor those I love through celebrations.
I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales 2, stories that bring the holiday season into focus in a new Christmas program from NPR.
Monday at noon on 91.7 WVXU.